we tune off the beat, south to south the beat, north where I'm from, Virginia, of course, south the beat, north the beat, south what it's like, hey yo, it is what it is, yeah, hey yo, what it is, hey yo, what it is, it couldn't be nothing else, we found our place off, on the south.
Andy, how you doing, man?
I'm all right, what's going on?
Did I get the time right?
Yeah, we're good.
I think you're the first person that I've talked to from the central time zone. So I sometimes get confused with all these time conversions to Pacific and Eastern and now Central. It always throws me off.
Yeah, I was in Oregon over the weekend, so I'm still not quite completely back on this time zone. So
yeah. You must be traveling around quite a bit with the band.
It's getting sort of busy, yeah.
Is this the busy time of year? Is summertime, you play a lot of festivals and stuff like that. You guys are all over the place?
Yeah, it can be. This is a new project I'm in. It started kind of in January, but snowballed really fast and is getting a lot of attention. So the guy in charge of it, it's called Black Pumas, and the guy in charge of that has a lot of connections. So this was a festival he booked before he even had a single out or anything. So that was out in Portland. Pretty cool festival called Pickathon.
Well, I listened to some of the Black Pumas tracks that were available. Can you tell me a little bit about the project?
Actually, I'm probably not on those because he did them just with, like, his studio buddies. And he just needed someone to play the shows when he decided to get it moving. But he had basically made these tracks, and then he met a singer. And the singer sort of fleshed out some lyrics, and then he put a band together and started playing shows, and now we have management and booking and all those scary things.
Under the raging sun's open fire in the blue, in the blue. I want you to be my woman, baby. Every time you get dressed in black, you give a grown man a heart attack. I pray that good Lord will bring you back. You're my sunshine. Shoot me down and break your heart. It's the black rising. Oh, you brave the sign.
Who is he?
Oh, that's his name is Adrian Quesada. If you knew him from anything, he was in a band called Grupo Fantasma and a band called Brownout here from Austin.
Brownout, so, they just did a Public Enemy album.
Yes.
I've been banging that one for the past week. I love it.
Yeah, I was kind of floored by that. They also had like this Black Sabbath tribute they did called Brown Sabbath.
Hell yeah. So I love that, that's how I discovered them.
Yeah. And I mean, they have this whole other, Latin resume beyond that. And Grupo played a residency for Prince, like in Vegas for a couple of years there. So he was involved in that, and they got a Grammy and all of that. So nice to be involved with someone who has a few light years more cred than I do.
How did you guys get involved together?
A few years back, he produced a couple singles for a band called Hardproof that I've had here in Austin. And at some point, I did sub a Brownout gig, and I subbed in his band, the Echocentrics, out at a festival in Marfa. So he kind of knew I could play, and so I'm on his Rolodex. Anyway, just lots of mutual friends, and I'm good friends with his regular drummer in Brownout, so there might have been a referral there.
Is there a different style that you're drawing upon for this project than what you're doing in Hardproof?
I'm having to dial it back. In Hardproof, I can kind of play whatever I want. I mean, I'm sort of the band leader, and we don't tell each other what to play or what not to play for the most part. So that's sort of a free-for-all, and whereas this one, like, I'm backing up a singer, so I have to stay out of his way and let the song do the talking, and kind of an exercise in playing simply.
Yeah, always hard for drummers.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a good exercise, and the songs are just really freaking good. You just want to do a good job and let them speak for themselves.
Well, I saw you posting about this project, so I was immediately intrigued and went and started listening myself. So if you guys are ever making it out here to L.A., I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah, it looks like we're at the Wiltern opening for St. Paul and the Broken Bones in October, so we're heading that way.
That'd be a great show.
Yeah.
Really great show. I like St. Paul and the Broken Bones a lot.
I don't know anything about them, but they got us on some really good dates, so obviously they're good people.
You know, they do kind of the funk soul revival thing.
Yeah.
And they do it really well.
Right on.
So let's take it all the way back, and you can explain some of your rest in cred for the folks that don't know who you are or where you come from. So why don't you explain who you are and where you come from?
Well, I was born in D.C. proper in 77, and my parents had two older brothers. They had lived off of Lake Ann in Inlet Court, and we lived there for the first 3 years of my life, so right in the middle of old school wrestling, but... So I guess I lived there from 77 to 97, haven't really been back a ton since. But, well, this is a Nova Music podcast, so I guess, like, that we had this music scene, and I mean, I kind of always knew that music was my thing, and I know, like, my older brother started going to the community center shows. I guess I was aware of that around fifth grade or so. I don't think I got to go to one until I was in junior high, but I just became aware pretty early, like, that music was a thing that anyone could do. It wasn't just this MTV thing, you know, like, I think the first CD I actually bought was a Bad Brains album in a long box from Kent Mill. And that was like, wait, these guys are from around here and they did this. and they found a label and all of that. But I think I got like a first, I mean, I did like school band or something in fifth grade, but I didn't last very long. I didn't do like school band again until high school. Like, I think I got annoyed by it or something, or just didn't have a very good band teacher. So I bailed in sixth grade, didn't touch it again until 10th grade. But me and my brother split a drum set around 7th grade, which I would never advise anyone split an instrument with a sibling because there will be fighting. But, like, slowly, I was self-taught for a minute, and then I had this teacher, Dave Goyser. I think Dennis Hoy studied with him, too. A whole bunch of us studied with him. He was out of Melody Music in Sterling. But so that guy sort of steered me in a few different directions. But around eighth grade, I started, there weren't many of us that played drum set, I don't think. So I eventually fell in with like Brendan Bobzien and Tom Mashke, and we had a little hardcore band that was originally called Constraint. So that was probably eighth and ninth grade. And I think we played maybe two shows ever that I can recall. So we played one of the things at the community center. And I know we played the Safari Club in D.C., which if you read your hardcore history books, it's like after the 930 Club, it probably was the second most important D.C. hardcore club, maybe. A lot of bands from, like, New York would come down and play it, and there were a lot of matinee shows there. But, yeah, so that's how I got into it. And I guess there were a lot of other bands. I had the only other band I can remember that played shows was me and Tom Mashke and Ben Blanton. Had something called, it had many names, but we settled on Super Big Ass Super Band, which is still one of my favorite band names of anything I've ever been involved in. That could probably have passed for like post rock if people even, like, it was mostly instrumental, but I don't know. I know we played like The Cave. Has anyone talked about The Cave in Manassas?
No.
That's like sort of crucial to the history. It was a really, I think it was like an old movie theater that they decided to have shows at. It was pretty random. Like lots of other random bands would come through. I know like 311 played there or something, but I seem to remember playing there like one New Year's Eve, and I don't know. I had no real projects that actually went anywhere.
Was anybody in your family musically inclined? Did you have any musicians that were in your family at all?
I mean, my brother had piano lessons, but we owned a piano. Not really. Not very musical people. I mean, you can hear this. I'm struggling to actually have some inflection in my voice. You may or may not recall what my dad's voice sounded like when he was announcing lacrosse games, but we're very monotone people, not very musical as it were, but I don't know, somewhere this had to have come from somewhere. I think like it skips a generation or something, but they're big music fans. Like they had a good record collection and they steered me in a good direction. Everybody was just into music.
And they've always been supportive of you playing in bands and you going into music?
For the most part, yeah. I mean, I ended up going to college for music and they paid for that and everything. So that's about as supportive as parents could be.
Well, they got you a drum kit. That's very supportive, allowing any kid to play drums in the house.
Actually, wait a minute. This is funny. I listened to Derek's interview on this podcast, and I remembered me and Derek went to preschool together, and one of the teachers at the preschool was Patty Wersler. Patty Wersler, she was a history teacher at South Lakes when we got there, but she's the one, she was like the adult sponsor of the Jam for Man concert. So she had actually been like my preschool teacher. And one day when I got like a toy drum set for my birthday, it had Muppets on it. I've talked to a lot of other drummers, but that was their first drum set too. But I definitely have some memory of my mom carting that toy drum set into Lank preschool and me bashing on it to a Beatles record in front of my classmates. Probably five. So maybe that was my first performance in Lank preschool.
I actually have a video of us, because we were in the same play group. I don't know if you remember this, in like the late 70s. So I have a Super 8 of us like banging on pots and pans, I think in my kitchen.
Whoa.
And that's probably the first, your first recorded performance on film.
Yikes.
So I can shoot that to you at some point. I won't post that along with this episode.
Yeah, I know we were like babysat at times together, and didn't y'all live on like Greenmont Court at one point?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it would be over there.
OG North Reston.
Exactly. I've got some OG Reston cred myself. So you mentioned Dave. I remember that teacher used to make Dennis like these mixtapes of things where he would like kind of like require him to listen to different kinds of music. Did he make those for you also? And was that part of like where your interest in African music stemmed from?
He definitely made me tapes. Still, I might have one, particularly, like, he was definitely a jazz and fusion head, so that definitely rubbed off on me and Dennis in a big way. And, I mean, we would hang out at his house, and we would watch a Redskins game or whatever, and at halftime, he would just fire up this ridiculous stereo and play records, and he just hipped us to some really cool stuff. That was probably the best and biggest takeaway from him, just steering me down the road of interesting music, drum-related. The African music thing, I always just wanted, like when I went off to music school, I wanted to understand it all, kind of back to the root. And I went to West Virginia University, which had a very world music focused program at the time. So I was in like an African drum ensemble the whole time I was there. And I went and studied in Africa, in Ghana specifically at some point. And, that was just part of my training. And I think if you really want to understand jazz and everything, it's something a drummer should really dig into. So that was more part of my college experience. But thanks to Dave, I was definitely a fusion head when I left Reston. It's like, lots of notes, lots of complicated time signatures.
So, wait a minute. What was it like playing music in Africa? Who did you play with? Like, what kind of music did you play? What were some of those experiences like?
That was more like traditional folkloric kind of studying, so drum and dance ensembles. So, we would have lessons at their university there in the capital, Accra. And then we'd go out to villages and watch local groups. know I went to a funeral, and I think I sat in with whatever group was just drumming. I mean, it's more of a, it's just a part of everyday life over there. Like, there's a song for everything, you know? Like, you were taking your kids to the first day of school, like I gather we were both doing today, there's probably a song for that, or whatever. And I mean, and I think the other day I remember very well is we went to a Catholic mass, which was accompanied by a brass band. So they were doing Western hymns, but with like a traditional folkloric drum accompaniment. So that was kind of funky. But in the afternoon, they took us to the shrine to their local thunder god, Yeve, and they initiated us into the shrine and made us dance around the square for about 4 hours. So in the course of the day, you get the Western colonial religion and you get the local, I guess you could call it a pagan religion. So I don't know. It's going back nearly 20 years at this point, but I wish I had stayed there longer. It was just a summer program, but definitely eye-opening. I think every musician needs to deal with Africa on some level like that. At least just understanding rhythm.
Well, it seems like some of that stuff has definitely stayed with you, and you're applying it, you know, to your playing in Hardproof. And just starting that band in general.
Yeah. I mean, all the basics are there, all the, you know, simple repetitive parts and an underlying concern for the dance being the most important part of the whole thing.
Yeah, I remember when Dennis and Kevin turned me on to, Kevin had this like documentary or something on King Sunny Ade and Juju music. And I remember them showing me the dances that they would have that were like these all night, you know, and sometimes into the next day, like sessions where people would just play and they'd be playing for, you know, 16 hours straight. Almost it was like trance-like states.
Yeah. I know, like, right. I had my professor in Morgantown was from Ghana, and had me, I was sort of like, I would help him with things, like I'd drive him to the embassy to pick up his visa or whatever, but he would have me house sit, and he just left all these videos, so, like, there were all these, like Fela videos or other African performance videos. So I would definitely dub those off of him and watch them to death.
Yeah. I remember, also, who is it? Is it Tony Williams or is it Tony Allen? I get confused by my
Tony Allen.
Tony Allen.
Yeah.
I remember Dennis sort of pointing out like Tony Allen and what he was doing on drums, and I'd never really I just never listened to that kind of drumming before. And yeah. he was very influenced by that in college and during that time. And it definitely became something that I started listening to a lot during that period also.
Yeah. I mean, me and all my roommates kind of got big into Fela, and we would play it at parties, and people went nuts for it. So, I mean, I knew I wanted to play that music. It's just I never was around the right tribe of people until... I mean, Hardproof has now been around for 10 years as of this month, so I've kind of been reflecting on how that came together lately, and I don't think it would have come together any time earlier than, you know, when I had first moved to Austin and I was piecing together something.
How did you go about, like, putting together a quote unquote Afrobeat band in Boston? I mean, in Austin, in, you know, 2008.
Well, actually, I went to audition for some indie rock band, and the keyboard player was like, "Hey, do you know anything about Afrobeat? Like, when we used to live in Brooklyn, like, these dudes, the Budos band, they were a pretty huge deal, and they drew a ton of people." And I don't know if he worded it that way. I kind of took it as a dare. And so out of this indie rock band that didn't really go anywhere, I got that keyboard player, and we got a saxophonist who had played on his record, and a trumpet player that I had just done, like, some free jazz gigs with, and everybody knew at least one other person. And then eventually, over the course of a year, we just said, we're going to meet at noon on Sundays, which was a pretty unpopular time for anyone to do anything. But that kind of weeded out people who didn't really want to do it. And after a year, we had sort of a lineup in place. And for the most part, it's been almost the same lineup until about 9 years ago when people started disappearing. Like, do you know the rock band Spoon?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, they kind of borrowed one of our keyboard guitar guys, and then one guy, well, we're not getting it back, basically. They stole him. So, and then one guy, the percussionist, moved to Colorado to do video game art or something like that. So I didn't really have to worry about the lineup for, like, 8 years, so just been finding other folks to play since the last record came out.
And what do you think of the record? That's Stinger, right?
Yeah, I was really proud of that one.
Where did you guys record that?
A couple different places. Mostly dealing with a rock producer here. His name is Frenchie Smith. Full name, Chris John Smith, but everybody calls him Frenchie. He's mostly a rock and roll dude. Like, he's worked with The Darkness and, like, the Toadies and stuff like that. Very much a 90s rock guy, but he works with all kinds of things. So we did a lot of it at his place. There are a few tracks that, there was one from an old session with Adrian Quesada, that guy I was talking about earlier, and there was two or three from a live session that, Converse, the shoe company, used to come into town during South by Southwest and rent out a studio, and it would gift a handful of bands, like, a full day of studio time. So we did a bunch of those, and we liked them enough to take them elsewhere and mix them for the record. So I think that's probably, you know, three live tracks and seven or eight we did with Frenchie, and then one with Adrian. So all over the place. And
what's your favorite track to play?
There was one called Incendiary that I thought came out really well. It's kind of a barn burner.
your live shows like? What's the energy like with the crowds in different places? How are people connecting to that, to what you guys did on Stinger?
I mean, usually it's a pretty raging dance party. It's kind of weird, like when we first started it, the first show was like really well attended, and I've been playing nothing but indie rock or straight ahead jazz for a good number of years before that. It's like I forgot what it was like to look out and see people actually dancing. So, like, this is kind of where it's at.
Definitely. Did you guys, have you now ever run across that band that you guys originally talked about? Have you ever run across the Blue Nose band now?
we opened for them once. I think it was during Fun, but those guys are funny. Those guys rage. Like, they definitely killed more than one bottle of Jameson on stage.
Well, they're an awesome dance party in and of themselves. I've never seen them live yet, but I know people that have checked them out a lot, and I like all their recordings a lot too.
Yeah,
they're great.
They're a blast.
So taking it back a little bit, did you play jazz at South Lakes? Were you involved in the South Lakes jazz band? Did you get your jazz start and chops back then?
I don't know that I had any chops. I think I was a little misdirected back then. I mean, I knew a little bit. We had this brilliant band director for my first 2 years in the high school band. This guy, Jeff Fraker, he was like, he was an alumni of the Buddy Rich band, which may or may not have had some influence on how he treated drummers in his life, because he took no shit off of us, honestly. I think he bailed after my junior year because Fairfax County discovered he had an accounting degree, and they were like, well, you're now going to teach pre-algebra first period instead of percussion. And he was like, yeah, I'll take a transfer. Thanks. So I think he's taught elementary music since then. But, I mean, he was great. I didn't do jazz band until senior year, and we had this lady who was only there for a year, and she didn't really want to do it, so we were kind of on our own. But, like, me and Dennis would listen to records and stuff, and, I know, actually, you slipped and said Tony Williams earlier, but I know my dad took me to Wolf Trap to see, well, it was the Miles Davis Quintet after Miles had passed. So it was the second 60s quintet with, like, Wayne Shorter and Herbie and Ron Carter and Tony Williams on drums and Wallace Roney on trumpet. So I'd say stuff like that was probably a bigger influence on me in the jazz realm as a high schooler. And also we had a good radio station, Jazz 90.1, which has been, it's a C-SPAN station now, sadly, but just having access to stuff like that, or, you know, Jazz Bows would come to the barns of Wolf Trap or Blues Alley or whatever, just having that stuff nearby was really convenient and helpful.
Yeah, that Miles Davis Quintet is my favorite jazz band of all time.
Yeah, I've been trying to track down a bootleg of that show because it's kind of, I want to say I was like a sophomore in high school. I'm like, it's sort of like a point where my life went wrong. Like, I know Tony played like three solos that night, and it was just, I was definitely not ready to process any of it, but I mean, like, Wolf Trap had just a great jazz festival every year too. That was pretty cheap. I know I went to that a bunch.
There were definitely shows that I saw at Wolf Trap that had really profound effects on me and were some of the shows that I ever went to. I got to see, John Lee Hooker a couple times there with my grandpa and Albert Collins. And I saw James Brown there twice. Yeah. Just great shows. I loved Wolf Trap.
Yeah, it's kind of unreal to think that, because I grew up close to Route 7, probably 3-4 miles from there. So it was just, not everybody, my wife is from north of Dallas, and, not everybody gets to grow up with all of that so close at hand. I took it for granted for a long time, but now, I live in a music town, so I can see whatever I want when I want. But when I travel, I'm not everybody has it so easy. So we had a whole lot of, every kind of music there in D.C.
Have you had the chance to go back and play any of those places that you saw shows at? Have you gone back and played? You can't play the old 930, but... have you played the 930 or Wolf Trap or any of those places, Black Cat?
Nowhere near as interesting as those. I want to say I played the Velvet Lounge and I played Tropicalia. I don't newer places, I guess, but. I have this hope that Black Pumas gets to play 930 Club because that's probably my number one Holy Grail kind of venue. I feel like I saw the most important shows there.
What did you see back in the day?
No, I saw Fishbone. That was kind of a big deal. The singer walked all the way around the balcony and then landed on my head. That was something else. I know I saw Maceo Parker there, Desky Martin and Wood several times. They were a big deal to me in the 90s. Just a ton of history in that room with that name.
Well, what are your feelings on DC Go-Go?
I think that's I can't think of many other purely indigenous things like that. I lived in New Orleans for a time, and brass band music from there seems like kind of a parallel. But, I do a little bit of journalism, and I got to write kind of a memoriam on a drummer named Ricky Wellman, and he was Chuck Brown's drummer in the 70s, and he was basically on the gig the night that they kind of stumbled on it, and from what I understand, Chuck hadn't shown up, and they were jamming out on Mr. Magic, that Grover Washington Jr. song. And they just kind of played that beat and went and went. And eventually Chuck came and talked over it. And that's kind of where it happened. I don't think anybody else grew up with that. If you think about it, people would tape it off of WPGC on a Friday. Because they used to play the live broadcast on Friday, if you remember. And
yeah.
You would hear it out of people's Jeep systems in the parking lot at school on Monday. I know we were out in the suburbs, but, it was definitely, it was a pervasive thing. Any drummer my age group from there will know those beats. And in a lot of our cases, we adapted horrible conga technique. From that music.
Can you explain to anybody as a drummer, anybody listening to this, what sets Go-Go apart?
What sets it apart. Man, it's kind of its own language and its own use of that palette. Like, you have the main beat, like, boom, scoot-up, boom, but and everything kind of works around that, and it's and you have the offbeat high conga thing. It's funny, the percussion companies make these junior congas, and I'm pretty convinced that the only reason there's still a market for them is that go-go bands always have them. Like, that high conga is like this half-size conga on a stand. And that's like really the only use I can think of for it. Like, I talk to conga purists, like Puerto Ricans and Cubans and stuff, and they're like, what would you do with that? I'm like, well, I know one reason, you know. But it's its own language and its own vocabulary, and if I were around it more, me and one drummer buddy here always joke about starting a band, and it's like, well, I'd have to have at least one more person from D.C. to pull it off with any legitimacy, and that would probably have to be the singer.
Well, you got an Afrobeat band, I mean, having a go-go band seems like the next logical progression.
Yeah, we'd see how it would go over here. Afrobeat was kind of a good marketing term when we started this one, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, Reston had its own share of a couple of go-go bands that people have talked about here on the show. So
Did anybody mention Split Decision? Because I remember watching them a whole lot.
That's what people have talked about. Although, and I've talked to several of the members of Split Decision. They're like, nobody can seemingly track down any recordings whatsoever.
Really?
So there are no Split Decision tapes. No VHSs, nothing seems to exist anywhere except for in people's memories. So I've talked to Andre, I've talked to Mike Beal, I've talked to Sam Gunderson, I've talked to all these people involved. Ian White.
That's funny. I think Mike Beal was like my first introduction to the conga drum. I remember, like, he would leave the stage and there would be blood on the drums. And that's what I assumed until I played in a salsa band in college, like what you were supposed to do playing the conga. Pretty funny. Let me bug my brother and see if he has a box of VHS tapes anywhere or something. Cause, he was like, I know he worked for like Channel 8 back in the day. So maybe
I tried to contact Channel 8 also. I never heard back. Yeah.
I know they did a lot. And my brother was kind of Mr. AV, and he would go tape these things, and he would bring them home, and that's kind of how I got to see a lot of them before I was allowed to go out. But I know he taped Split Decision at some point.
See what you can do. And also, I'd love to have a copy of your performance at graduation, too.
I think if anyone had that, it's probably Brent Proctor. He's probably sitting on it. I don't know if I could watch that without curling up in a ball.
Why is that?
Oh, I don't know. I might have had a questionable haircut that week.
I had a lack of haircut.
Yeah. I had dreadlocks for a couple of months, and white boys just didn't do that. I think I cut them off like the next week, so I don't know. Fred's probably sitting on tapes of like bad projects we did in Dennis's basement that nobody wants to talk about. But I mean, there were a lot of, there were, for every band I actually played a show with in Reston, there were like a million just fuck off projects in somebody's basement or whatever. But there was lots of room for that back then.
Well, that's the only time I remember seeing you play with Kevin. Did you play with him on it at any other time?
No, I mean, I was just, because, like, I was a drum set player. Dennis was a drum set player. I would sit in and play some percussion here and there, but didn't really want to be the third wheel on that thing. I know we had some jams later on, but that was about it. And I went away to college, and they kind of did their thing. I want to say Dennis probably has a copy of this. There was a band called the Ludovico Technique, and Dennis was in the band, but he was going to audio school at Omega Studios in Rockville, and he had me play on their demo for like his class project or whatever. So that's probably out there somewhere. That's probably an interesting little musical memory.
I remember those recordings. That also had Tom on it, right? Playing guitar.
Yes. And Tom and Ben and Stan. I think he was in Psychotic Symptoms as well.
That's interesting. That's a name that I've seen. Like, Tom played with them too, or was that Chris that played it? Chris played with Psychotic Symptoms.
Chris was
right?
In Psychotic Symptoms.
And I know that they played some, at least one of the Jam for Man shows.
Yeah, they played a bunch of those, and I know there was a big house show scene back then.
Do you have any prized tapes or like 7 inches or whatever from that time from the local scene?
I'd have to go looking for tapes. I know I have like one LDK tape, but it's probably from a post Andy Wells lineup. Actually, I have a snare drum from the drum kit that Tim Berry sold me, like when he switched from drums to vocals in a Veil, he sold me his drums. The rest of it is owned by a very nice public defender in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania that I used to be in a band with, but I still have a snare drum. I debated showing up at a Tim Berry show and making him sign it, but that seemed a little weird, and I had a gig that night. But, yeah, I lost, like, most of my tapes and stuff in Katrina. I think, like, I'm wagering between the Mashke brothers, they probably have all of it, if you can ever get in touch with them. I know they're busy guys. You could probably corner them at their barbecue stand. Did you know they have a barbecue trailer?
Hogmeister.
Yeah. I need to. My folks tell me it's good. It's at the Reston Farm Market right by my parents' house. So,
well, you should know.
Yeah, I do.
You should
know
good barbecue.
Yeah. I've been in Texas for 12 or 13 years now. So I have tried all the brisket.
And what's the best brisket in Texas?
Oh, that's tough. My favorite is probably there's no short answer to this, but I'll say like Kreutz's in Lockhart, Texas is about 30 minutes south of here. And there's a lot of Austin people moving to Lockhart because it's cheaper than Austin. Austin is getting really expensive.
It's getting real expensive all over, Steve.
Yeah.
It's hard to live anywhere.
I never even considered moving back to Reston because I finished college I worked on a cruise ship for about 2 seconds as a drummer, and then I got home and I looked in a one-bedroom apartment was like $1,100 or something, and that was 18 years ago. So, I mean, I ended up in Pittsburgh for 3 years. That was much cheaper. Then I did grad school in New Orleans, but Katrina happened, and then I ended up in Austin somewhere after that. But, yeah, I wish I could say moving back home was ever a thought in my mind, but it was just like, nah, if you're going to pay somewhere, if you're going to pay it to live anywhere that much, like, you might as well just be moving to Manhattan or something.
I love New Orleans. I think it's one of my favorite places ever. It was my grandpa's favorite city, and we went down there a bunch of times. He was really, really into Dixieland jazz.
Yeah.
What was it like living there pre-Katrina and at, you know, as a musician, as a working musician? And you've mentioned Katrina a couple times, so what were your experiences from that?
I mean, before the storm, it was, I mean, I got working pretty fast there, and I only lived there for a year, but I didn't play any gigs that weren't jazz, which is the only time in my life I can say that. But, I mean, I knew it wasn't permanent, but I figured I'd get a couple of years in there. But, so then the storm happened, and I evacuated to Texas, but started emailing like jazz departments, seeing if I could come take a few classes, because it was very apparent that I would not be going back to school in New Orleans anytime soon. So NYU took me in, and that was cool. I mean, they had a lot of famous people in residence teaching there. And, like, I got to be in an ensemble taught by Wayne Krantz, who's still one of my favorite guitar players. So getting to hear his take on everything was really cool. But there was still a rough time, you know, like just being homeless for a minute there and losing pretty much everything. But eventually I ended up in Austin, and after some false starts, I think it was probably the best fit possible for me out of anywhere I could think of. So this is definitely home now. And I mean, I can get away with being in however many different kinds of rock bands, plus an alleged Afrobeat band, as well as playing weddings and whatever else I want to get into. Things aren't so categorized here as maybe they were in New Orleans. Like, if you were a jazz guy in New Orleans, people expected you to be that guy all the time.
Have you played on any other interesting sessions? Like, any other bands that have come through and you recorded on, you know, just random songs or with random bands?
I mean, I do a bit of that here and there. Like, I know I made an album with an Alaskan singer-songwriter.
No paper big enough for what I'm going to draw today. There are no letters tall enough for what I've got to say. But all the margins are not mine. I run outside the lines, I run outside the lines, I run outside. Forward, I'm going to draw today. Oh, grass.
And sometimes I do get calls for quote unquote session work. Usually it's people I know though. So not so much working with strangers. But I mean, the whole goal of going to music school was like, no matter what comes across my plate, like somebody wants me to play Caribbean music, I can do that. Or like last year, I made a Western swing record that if you had told me I would be doing that 5 years prior to that, I would have laughed you out of the room. But that's another way you can make money in the state of Texas. And I consider it like if I lived in New Orleans, I would probably be taking traditional jazz or Dixieland gigs. Like, you know, if you want to eat in Texas, you have to make old blue-haired people dance to Western swing music sometimes. Musician type life, I guess. I mean, since Reston, I've worn a lot of hats since then. So,
thinking about the Reston music scene, you know, that you kind of came out of originally, like, what are your thoughts on that scene overall, looking back? Kind of 25, 30 years later?
I mean, I think we were pretty blessed to have the outlets that we had. Like, we had those community center shows. You could get downtown by, like, Metro back then. You had to take a bus and a train, but if you wanted to go see a show, like, I know I saw Grey Matter in some park in near DuPont Circle or something. I seem to remember. I don't remember what I had to tell my parents to go do that, but it probably wasn't the truth. But, you know, we had all these resources. I feel like maybe I didn't take advantage of them enough. But another thing is, like, we had some pretty amazing record stores there. It's like as soon as we could drive, we just had this ongoing competitive record collecting thing going on. So, like, if I was hanging out with Dennis or Tom Mackey or Brendan Bosley or something, like, we'd get a car and we'd go to, like, Record Convergence or Record and Tape Exchange or Smash Downtown or... there were two really good Tower Records. I remember them. Those people got all my money. So not everybody grew up in a town with, like, one good record store, let alone, you know, 20 within a reasonable drive. So that was all good to have. But, I mean, as far as the scene, it was a really cool thing to have. I don't know if it was as prominent like in our little age group, but the influence of everybody's older brother being in a band or going to see lots of bands, that was sort of a huge deal.
Your brother had similar taste to you I mean, did it,
yeah.
What kind of stuff did he turn you on to?
I mean, we both kind of got into metal at the same time, and then like hardcore and whatnot. And even when he went off to college, he would send me mixtapes and stuff. So he kind of kept me tuned in. And, I mean, he still does hit me to stuff. And he actually, he ran sound at a venue called The Warehouse Next Door for many years when he lived back there. I mean, he's been in Colorado for a couple of years now. But, so, I mean, he was always sort of keeping up and running sound for those people. And actually, his house in Vienna for a while was a show space. I think it was just called DC Greenhouse or something like that. I know sometime after I graduated college, I saw a show in his basement. So
cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, so do you think... you know, Reston has had like the greatest influence on you musically of all those places that you've played and been in?
I don't know. I mean, I'm always going to be a DC parenthetical area kid, but you know, when you move away, you just tell people you're from D.C. because it's less confusing than actually I'm from this place in Fairfax, Virginia. But, you know, I'm always going to be a D.C. kid at heart. So, you know, Fugazi is the greatest rock and roll band, and I will argue with you to the death about that. And then all of that, like, Go-Go is always going to be a part of me, whether I was a white kid from the suburbs or not. Just it was always present, you know. So, yeah, I mean, as far as that early phase, it's all still there. But then, you know, I went off to West Virginia and studied classical percussion and world music, so that's another phase. And then I lived in Pittsburgh for a few years, where I played in like a power pop band, and I played a lot of straight ahead jazz and a lot of steel drum music. So there's another phase. And then Louisiana, and I guess in Austin I kind of tied it all together. So I don't know, everything goes in phases, I guess. But Reston is definitely a good place to start
and a good place for us to end up. It sounds like you've had a pretty amazing life in music, and you continue to put out great stuff that I'm really enjoying over here.
Cool, I'm glad to hear that.
Well, thank you for taking the time to be on Dance for a Man today. I really appreciate it, man. It's great to catch up with you and talk to you and hear about your journey, you know, every step of the way.
Right on. The pleasure's all mine, man. Thank you so much for having me.